I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the highly regarded authors on religion of our time, Karen Armstrong, joins me now. She's just published her latest book, Fields of Blood, Religion, and the History of Violence. It's a thoroughly engaging book on how religion and violence seem to be connected, seem to be blamed for all the wars in our history. It's the contention of the author, however, that history suggests otherwise, that in fact it's it's religion that's the scapegoat, and perhaps we need to look at how other factors inspire and carry out violence. The book also looks at aggression and whether humans are wired for violence. I'll get Karen Armstrong to tell us about this book and how we should view the fanaticism that we see with ISIS, as well as the warped concept of religion factored in recent deaths of soldiers here in Canada. Karen Armstrong is the author of, among other best-selling titles, A Case for God, A History of God, The Battle for God, Holy War, and The Great Transformation. She was awarded the TED Prize in 2008 and has founded the International Charter for Compassion. She lives in Britain but joined me last week from here in Vancouver as she was about to speak to an audience with Simon Fraser University Center for Dialogue. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program Karen Armstrong. Ms. Armstrong, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
So you've been traveling quite a bit for this book in recent weeks. Where were you able to celebrate your birthday a few days ago?
I was in San Francisco.
I see. Yeah. It was a good celebration, I hope?
Well, I was very busy that day, and there were times when I completely forgot it was my birthday, but then members of the audience would kindly remind me of it.
So this book has been widely received, whether here in Canada or in the United States. It's a timely book, isn't it?
Well, it is, but this topic has been with us for some time, but it certainly has risen to new proportions with the whole conflict with ISIS. But I've been long worrying about this problem, because ever since 9/11, I've been having to speak about such matters, about why such atrocities committed in the name of religion, and how far religion is responsible for this. And it's long troubled me that even though my contention is not that religion is not implicated in some of these catastrophes, obviously it is, but that it's never the sole nor even the chief cause. Historians of warfare tell us that we always go to war for a multiple interconnected reasons, never just for a single motive. We go to war for territorial gain, for political motivation, and also especially for the economic advance. That's one of the most common causes of warfare. Similarly, atrocity, terrorism. Scholars tell us that these motives are always mixed, even that even if an atrocity has been caused or has been claimed to be performed in the name of religion, it's inherently political. Terrorism is always about power, changing power, grabbing power. And so the political and the religious are combined in a kind of cocktail. To take religion out of it and isolate it in that way and make it to blame is as mistaken as trying to take the gin out of the cocktail. So completely do these different motivations go in here.
But it's a simple sort of knee-jerk reaction we have just to blame religion. And who would you blame for that? Is that the media, perhaps? Is that religious scholars themselves?
I think the media is to blame. I think we don't hear enough at the present time about all the Muslim initiatives and to create peace and to fight extremism. We just highlight the more aggressive voices of in the Muslim world, and that's giving us a very false perception of Islam and of our present predicament. We've got to see what our real enemies are. After 9/11, the Gallup did the largest poll it's ever done in 35 Muslim-majority countries, interviewing millions of people over 7 years. And one of the questions they asked was, were the 9/11 attacks justified? And 93 of the respondents said no, they were in no way justified, and that The reasons they gave were all religious, quoting the Quran, which says that to take a single life is to destroy a whole world. And similarly, the 7% who said that they were justified, their reasons for saying this were entirely political and not religious at all. So I think these kind of findings don't get aired enough in the media, and it makes it easy for us to do this kind of scapegoating.
Have you found since September 11th, 2001, that there's been less of a tolerance for religion?
Not for religion itself, but certainly for Islam. I mean, in many ways, I know people say that the religion is on the decrease, even in the United States. But to me, coming from Europe, from a very secular Britain, America, or at least the United States, seems extremely religious still. And in fact, after 9/11, there was an absolute surge in religiosity in most denominations. Canada's a bit more like us, I think, us British. You're more secular here.
And did you find in this propagating of the idea that religion and violence seem to go together and seem to be the root of the problems, atheists, because there's been a rise sort of in atheists, maybe not in the numbers, but certainly in the profile of atheists in our culture and our discourse. Do you think they have had?
I think they've helped to spread this myth that religion is inherently violent. People like Hawkins and Hitchens and Dawkins. Mm-hmm. I think that is true. But it's also the idea that religion and violence is also ingrained in our Western secular consciousness. Mm. When we separated religion and politics in the 18th century, this was an absolute innovation. It's very difficult for us to understand this, but before the modern period, all state ideologies were inherently religious. The idea of religion as a private, personal quest that should not be introduced into public life was absolutely unheard of. When the Enlightenment philosophers proposed it, it was as revolutionary as the commercial economy that they were discovering at this time, and that would shortly transform the world. No other culture has anything like that notion of our modern Western version of religion. The only faith tradition that does fit that profile is Protestant Christianity, which is, like this version of idea of religion in the West, a product of the early modern period. And one of the reasons given for doing this was that it was thought that the terrible wars of religion in Europe in the 16th and 17th century had been entirely caused by the quarrels of the Reformation. But of course that wasn't true. If it were true, we wouldn't expect in these terrible wars that lasted for over a century and left a third of the population of Central Europe dead, we wouldn't expect to find Catholics and Protestants fighting on the same side. But in fact, they often did so and consequently fought their co-religionists. This was also, even though the participants certainly experienced these wars in a religious way, it was also a deeply political struggle to create to bring to birth what now has happened in Europe, where we have a number of independent states rather than a single transcontinental empire. But the myth has persisted.
Yeah.
It was promoted by Enlightenment philosophers, and so there's a general feeling today that if only countries could leave their benighted religions to one side and not involve them in politics, peace would break out. But this really has not proved to be the case, because in its short period, secularism has been very violent indeed, just as, you know, just like the old pre-modern states. The mass killing that we see in ISIS has been part of the modern experience. We are quite rightly revolted by these terrible beheadings, but during the French Revolution, which created the first secular state, in Europe, 17,000 men, women and children were beheaded publicly in a single year. And similarly, in the World War One, the Young Turks, a defiantly unreligious and atheistic party who took control in what is now Turkey, massacred over 1 million Armenians in order to create a purely Turkic state. The two world wars were not caused by religion, but by secular nationalism. So it's simply inaccurate for us to say that religion's the cause of all the major wars in history. We need to look at the other factors. Otherwise, we're not looking at our current predicament clearly and rationally and taking into account issues and factors that we really have to deal with just as much as religious extremism.
Most of the people from ISIS are generally ignorant of Islam, and from what we've heard of the more recent cases of these folks, they're new to the religion, is that right?
Yes, indeed. This has been one of the findings that forensic psychiatrists have discovered since 9/11. Just before they left England in May to join the jihad in Syria, two of these would-be jihadists had downloaded Amazon for Dummies from Amazon, which tells you about the level of their Islamic commitment. Since 9/11, it's been found that all the huge number of people who were involved in the 9/11 atrocity, plus all the lone wolf terrorist attacks that have happened since then, that of all these people, only about 20% of them have had a regular Muslim upbringing. The other 80%, the vast majority, are either new to Islam, like the gunner who attacked the Canadian Parliament just recently, or they are non-observant, like the Boston Marathon bombers, mm-hmm. or they're just self-taught. Many of them don't start reading the Quran seriously until they get to prison. And one forensic psychiatrist who's made a leading contribution to this has said that the problem is not so much Islam, but ignorance of Islam. And if they'd had a regular Muslim education, that might have deterred them from their crimes. One of the things that is driving these young men to warfare has driven young men to the battlefield throughout history, a sense of triviality and meaninglessness in their lives. I was talking last month to one of our leading military historians in Britain, and he said, look, one of the reasons why young men go to war is boredom. Mm. Chris Hedges, the New York Times war correspondent, has written a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and says that it's only in the intensity of the battle, which gives men particularly an adrenaline high, does the triviality of so much civilian life become apparent.
So religion can play a part in all of this. I guess they can; those of faith can allow their religions to not be co-opted by fanatics. They can also provide, say, meaning to people's lives and stem that sort of boredom that you've just talked about.
It can, and it's also significant that we focus so much on the violence that religion has committed. We don't take sufficiently into account the pacifist strain that has been just as important in the history of religion as any crusade or jihad. That all of them have developed, all the faith traditions quite independently have developed the golden rule, never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself, and have originally seen this as a political mandate, not just a personal one for your individual lives. The Hebrew scriptures tell us to love the foreigner. If a stranger lives with you in your land, do not molest him. You must treat him as one of your own people and love him as yourself, for you were strangers in Egypt. Jesus said, love your enemies, which didn't mean that we had to be filled with sort of tender affection for our enemies or even like them. The word love in the ancient Near East, hesed in Hebrew, was used in international treaties when two kings, former enemies, would promise to love each other, which meant that they would give each other practical aid, come to their defense in times of trouble, and or have their best interests at heart rather than our own self-interested, greedy, short-term goals. Now, it seems to me that unless now, in our highly globalized and interconnected world, we learn to implement the golden rule globally so that we treat all peoples, whoever they are, as we would wish to be treated ourselves, the world is simply not going to be a viable place. ISIS is just one example of how disaffection can explode in the most appalling way. And so I think we need to remember that religion has done lots of different things. And one of them has been to help people to spread their benevolence beyond their own congenial group, something that the nation state, with its emphasis on the nation, has yet to do in our globalized world.
Ms. Armstrong, I want to ask you what you think of Pope Francis and whether you think his time in the papacy will change anything with regards to how the Catholic Church operates, how it's perceived in the wider world.
Well, you know, I really like to see what Francis is doing. He's become a master of the gesture which speaks volumes, more than all the encyclicals and wordy declarations can do. For example, when he went to Israel-Palestine and laid his head in contrition at the wall in Yad Vashem against the Western Wall in Jerusalem, and then did exactly the same thing when he saw when he was taken to the wall that divided the Israel from the West Bank. And that gesture made a huge difference in the Muslim world. It just spoke volumes. I hope he'll be with us for a long time, because the papacy really needed someone like that, someone who is living much more closely to the Gospels. Instead of living in splendor, he's living in a sort of three-star apartment block with other clerics, not putting himself on a pedestal, making himself accessible to the people. My fear, however, is that I believe he's not in very good health, and that this is a man who feels that he's got a lot to do in a short time. My fear is that the old guard, the curia, will come down and try to restore the status quo of Benedict the 14th, because that's what happened after John the 23rd at his Vatican Council.
Well, when you write a book like Fields of Blood, I assume you go into the process with a lot of questions. After you're done, did you find you have just as many questions as you have answers?
Always. But I think, too, what happens is you go in with a number of ideas that you're going to write. And during the course of your research, at a very early stage, all those ideas that you originally have get knocked to pieces by what you're discovering. And something new comes out of it that you hadn't expected. I usually do 5 drafts of each book. And it's as though the book is talking to you, and back, it's your subconscious, really, so that you're beginning to see what you're really trying to say. It is a process of discovery, of forging forward to try and bring something new to the table.
This book has given me much to ponder, and just as many answers as I've gotten out of it. I must say that I've had more questions from it.
But that's indeed what we should have in our world.
Right.
There's far too much misplaced certainty, which is not helping us in our present troubles.
It's been such a pleasure to speak with you today, Ms. Armstrong. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. It's from Knopf. It's author Karen Armstrong. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.